or feast. Several of the soldiers in the troop hold stared at Dohai. Rico patted him on the shoulder and then went back to helping the shell-shocked kids. Dohai was proud they had managed to save these children, but today sure as shit didn't feel anything close to a victory. Chapter 4.
I think we're getting close, Beckham said.
Next to him, Horn twisted to look out the window of the helicopter. The bright light of the afternoon sun filled the cabin with a yellow glow as the chopper curved through the air. Marines sleeping in the leather seats stirred awake. Others were already alert, checking their weapons and gear. Nearly 16 hours had passed since the collaborators hit the White House, and in that time, over half of the 98 outposts had suffered devastating attacks. Outposts near the target cities were on the brink of falling. Beckham had spent most of that time in the air, first traveling from the White House to Outpost Portland, then to the USS George Johnson, and now back to Outpost Portland. He was anxious to get on the ground and join the battle, but feared he'd already lost his chance to make a difference. The Marines looked ready to jump back into the fray as well. Their leader was an eager sergeant named Buck, with big eyes and a thin mustache.
"What's the latest, Sergeant?" Beckham asked.
"They're still fighting on the ground, according to aerial surveillance, sir," Buck replied. "I haven't heard from Lieutenant Niven's team for over an hour, so there's no telling how bad it really is."
Beckham stood and walked to the cockpit.
"How much longer?" he asked, hoping for more information.
"About 10 minutes," said a pilot. "We're working on identifying a secure LZ. Sounds like Command wants us to put down at the University of Southern Maine."
Beckham brought a hand to shield his eyes from the glare of the sun. He leaned forward for a better view as they closed in on the shoreline. Thick columns of black smoke billowed away from the center of the outpost. Most of that smoke rose from two specific locations within the city. No flames chewed through Peaks Island, and Beckham didn't see any charcoaled buildings or pillars of smoke. The island might have been spared from the fires, but Beckham knew he wasn't returning home there anytime soon. Radio chatter crackled from their contacts on the ground. One of the pilots replied,
"Roger that."
"Prepare for landing," the other pilot said over the internal channel.
Beckham returned to his seat. The bird lowered over an abandoned part of the city. Then they flew over the first line of defense, blocked off streets and a wall of razor wire-tipped fences. Soldiers manned machine guns in the guard towers. Other groups patrolled the FOB's perimeter, weapons in hand. One soldier raised a hand into the air as the chopper passed over.
"Get ready, everyone," Buck said. "We're headed straight to the FOB for assignments."
The Marines all finished their final preparations as the chopper descended toward the lawn of the university. It touched down with a slight jolt, and the crew chief opened the doors. Beckham and Horn followed the Marines out and marched toward a group of soldiers holding a perimeter. Even from a distance, Beckham could see the bags under their eyes and the glassy expressions of exhaustion they wore. Splotches of blood covered their fatigues. Sergeant Candace Ruckley was one of them. She limped over with a bandage covering her right arm and another wrapped around her thigh.
"Good to see you, Sergeant," Beckham said.
Horn looked her up and down.
"Looks like you took a hell of a beating."
"Never thought I'd see the sun again," she said. "Also, didn't think I would see you two back here so fast."
"We came to help and get our friends," Horn grunted.
"Kind of late for the fighting," Ruckley said. "A few collaborators are pinned down toward the southeastern edge of the city, but they won't last another hour."
She jerked her helmet, indicating for them to follow her.
"I'll take you to the information tent first. We can check on the location of your friends while our teams mop up the rest of those animals."
"What the hell happened last night?" Beckham asked.
"The collaborators hit us from inside the outpost, sir. Not long after you took off," Ruckley said.
She pointed to the plumes of dark smoke.
"The sons of bitches blew up the water tower, took out the power station, and tore through our checkpoints," she said. "All right behind our backs. Someone in here was definitely coordinating with them."
The guilt of not seeing this coming ate at him. He could stomach their failure to predict the monsters breeding and scheming beneath the cities, but this... The collaborators had been under his nose the entire damn time.
"Do we know who yet?"
Horn asked.
Ruckley shook her head.
"Unless we got a good forensic analyst in town, we're not going to."
"What do you mean?" Horn asked. "They escaped?"
blew themselves to bits, Ruckley said sourly.
Beckham halted. It was a suicide bomber?
The one in the power station was, she replied. That set everything off. The rest of the damage was from Laws and AT-4s.
Horn's lip curled into a snarl. Beckham felt the same surge of anger.
Don't worry, Ruckley said. Most of the people are fine, just a bit frightened.
Hearing that helped quell the rage a little, but most didn't mean all. Beckham wouldn't be satisfied until he knew that Donna, Beau, and Timothy were among the safe ones.
I have a hard time believing someone we know could have helped the collaborators last night, Horn said. I can't think of anyone that would do something like this.
What's hard to believe is how they could have access to such powerful weapons, Ruckley said.
Is it, though? Beckham asked. We thought the variants were dying off under the cities, and seeing as how they were thriving, it makes sense the collaborators were, too.
He's right. And there could be a lot more of the assholes, Horn said. We have to start searching.
Already working on it, Ruckley said. We've been interviewing witnesses, tracking down anyone who is remotely suspicious, and reinforcing checkpoints to prevent more collaborators from sneaking into our borders.
Good, Beckham replied. We've got to focus on stomping out any final collaborators and securing the outpost before the next wave. Ruckley stopped in her tracks and winced as she rotated her injured body.
Next wave?
This looks like it's just the beginning to me, Horn said. They're trying to destroy our resources and infrastructure while they probe our defenses to prepare for the real attack.
Let them come. Ruckley spat on the ground. We'll be ready.
Beckham had other thoughts on the matter, but kept them private for now. He wanted to evaluate the situation first. The trio crossed the dry brown grass between the university buildings to the information tent. A young woman with curly hair sat behind a folding table. She looked up from an open ledger.
How can I help you? She asked.
We're looking for Donna and Beau Tufo and Timothy Temper, Beckham said.
Going to take a bit to locate them, she replied. We moved a lot of people around today. Come back in 20 or 30 minutes and we'll have better information.
Thanks, Ruckley said, then turned to Beckham.
I'll take you to the roof of Corthell Hall. It has the best views of this area. You can see the damage from there.
Beckham followed her with Horn through the campus. They entered the hall that was now serving as makeshift barracks for the soldiers deployed to protect the outpost. When they made it upstairs, three snipers were camped out on the roof. Sleeping bags, MRE wrappers, and gear littered the space. Ruckley pulled out her radio. She called her platoon officer, Lieutenant David Niven, as they walked over to the ledge.
Sir, I have Captain Beckham here if you have updates for him. We're on top of Corthell.
Hold tight up there. Niven replied. I'll be there soon.
Copy that, sir, she replied.
Horn sidled up near one of the snipers.
Where are the collaborators?
They all pointed toward a building across the interstate near West Bayside, not far from the hotel where Beckham had spent several days with his family after the first attack. Ruckley handed Beckham a pair of binoculars. He took them and zoomed in on MATVs and Humvees surrounding the structure. A group of soldiers hugged the eastern facade, waiting to storm the building. Beckham had wanted back in the action, but here he was again, watching from a distance. Still, there were other things he could do to help.
Where are the checkpoints the collaborators hit? He asked.
Ruckley pointed toward the northwestern side of the city.
They tried to take out another checkpoint there, but we stopped them, she said.
He centered his sights on a blackened vehicle on a road leading west. Concrete barriers blocked off the road, and a team of soldiers stood behind sandbags.
Captain Beckham? Master Sergeant Horn? Came a voice.
Lieutenant Niven joined them at the edge of the rooftop.
LT, Horn said.
They exchanged formalities.
Hell of a night. Day wasn't much better. But we stopped them, and are in the process of relocating most of our resources, Niven said. Still got about half of our people in West Bayside, but the area will be secured soon.
Becca moved the binos back to the building surrounded by armored vehicles. Soldiers were already walking out of it, carrying bodies between them.
Who's in charge of the outpost now? Beckham asked.
That would be me, Niven replied.
Good. As native to this place, I've got some questions.
I'm all ears.
I'd recommend moving everyone from West Bayside to the campus, Beckham said.
We were telling Ruckley that we think the attacks on those checkpoints were just the enemy testing our defenses.
They cut the power, took out the water tower, Horn said. They're gonna be back. Maybe it'll be tonight, maybe tomorrow night. They'll hit harder. And I'll bet you dollars to donuts they come back with variants, too.
Niven looked out over the campus.
Pulling the non-combatants here might not be a bad idea. It would at least cut down on the real estate I need to protect. But this thing about variants, you really think they'd come all the way out here?
Based off the experience of other outposts, I wouldn't be surprised if the beasts show up sooner rather than later, Beckham said.
How many troops are stationed here? 150 plus the 200-strong local militia, Niven said.
Sounds like a lot, but not against hundreds of variants, Beckham said. Not to mention we've gotten reports across the Allied states that armored juveniles are joining in the assaults.
Then we've got to move fast, Niven said. Sergeant Ruckley, give the order. Ruckley started relaying the command over her radio.
Niven turned back to Horn and Beckham. I take it you two didn't come all the way back here just to offer a little advice. What brings you back?
We came to finish the fight, but it looks like things are under control, Beckham said. We should have stayed last night.
It's still good to have you here now, Niven said. And besides, the President needs you more than I do. Your family needs you too. Time to let people like me and Ruckley do our share.
Ruckley cracked a grin. Everything's taken care of. We're going to start the evac. Permission to check on their friends, sir.
Go,
Niven said. Beckham and Horn followed Ruckley back down to the campus grounds. The young woman at the information tent was still looking over the ledger when they got there. Her eyes caught Beckham's on their approach.
I found Donna and Bo Tufo, but Timothy Temper has left the outpost.
What? Beckham said, narrowing his eyes.
I'm still trying to figure out where the militia group he's with went, she said.
Hold on. Militia? Beckham asked, heart pounding.
That's gotta be wrong, Horn said. Timothy's no militia soldier. Check again.
The girl looked back down, and then back up again.
Timothy Temper?
Yeah,
Horn said.
He went out with a group of militia soldiers.
She jabbed her finger on the ledger.
Says so right here.
Can you tell us where they went? Beckham asked.
Not exactly. All I know is they're out west hunting a truck of those collaborators.
That's variant territory, Horn said, face turning red.
Beckham couldn't imagine what would have compelled the militia to head out there when the outpost was in jeopardy like this. But he did know what had compelled Timothy to go with them. A memory surfaced of Timothy's father, Jake, bleeding out back on Peaks Island after the raider attack. No doubt the same group affiliated with these collaborators. Timothy wanted revenge.
What should we do, boss?
Horn asked.
Timothy's not ready for this. He has no idea what he's getting himself into.
You're not actually considering going after them, are you? Ruckley asked.
That's exactly what I'm considering, Beckham said. We're considering, Horn corrected. You ain't going out there alone.
Timothy thought back to the hunting trips he had taken with his dad when he was younger. In a way, this wasn't that different, aside from the prey they were tracking. At least that's what he kept telling himself. But deep down, he knew that was a lie. This was very different. And the farther away they went from Portland, the more he felt like the prey. He marched with a group of 12 militia soldiers carrying M-16s down a dirt road about 20 miles away from the outpost. Two trucks trailed them. They had chased a Jeep Cherokee until the vehicle had run out of gas and the collaborators inside disappeared into the forest. The militia soldiers had lost the trail and were back on the road on foot. Timothy was in the middle of the group, his father's Remington 870 Wingmaster 12-gauge shotgun cradled in his arms. Several of those men had known his father, but none of them seemed to know who Timothy was. The group leader was a guy named Stephen Rhodes, a guy about as old as Timothy's dad. Stephen was in good shape. He wore green fatigues with a baseball cap and scarf to match. He hadn't even questioned Timothy when he claimed he was 18 years old and wanted to join the militia right there and then. Get in the truck if you're coming, Stephen had said. Timothy had hopped into the pickup's bed, and they had raced out of the city. The only regret he had was not dressing a bit warmer,
especially now with the late afternoon sun behind the trees. He shifted the weight of his shotgun and scanned the forest. They were on the border of Variant territory now, maybe even inside it for all he knew. In his mind's eye, he could picture his dad yelling at him about how dangerous this mission was. Beckham and Horn would have something to say about it too, but Timothy didn't care. He didn't want to sit back in the outpost, scared and crying. He wasn't afraid of dying. Without his father, he was already dead. The dread returned, filling his chest and gut. Anger replaced it from time to time, but right now he just felt empty. His dad had been his world. Stephen balled his fist, and the group halted. The trucks behind them crunched over the dirt road before coming to a stop. Silence passed over the road. The two drivers stepped out of the trucks, joining the huddled group.
"We definitely lost the trail," Stephen said in a gruff voice. "We can turn back or head into these woods to try and pick up a new one."
The men around Timothy looked at each other as if gauging what their comrades wanted to do. Timothy raised his chin, trying not to show any fear.
"I say we keep going."
"Me too," said another.
"I won't lie to you. The sun sets early, and night will be here before we know it," Stephen said. "We aren't prepared to hunt in the dark, and we could very well run into a pack of variants."
He shrugged.
"On the other hand, if you're like me, I'm guessing most everyone in this group lost someone to those bastards or you wouldn't have volunteered. This could be our best chance of catching up to them."
Timothy thought back to what Bighorn and Beckham had told them about the Army Rangers giving up the chase when they literally had the collaborators in sight.
"Military sure as hell ain't gonna do it," Timothy said. "They had their chance once, and let them get away."
"How about this?" Stephen said. "Half of us will continue on. The rest will head back to the outpost just in case we need backup."
Six of the militia soldiers climbed into a truck with one driver, and the engine rumbled back to life. The departing truck did a U-turn and headed back. The remaining five soldiers, including Stephen, fanned out into the forest as the driver of the second truck waited in the cab for their return. Timothy walked into the weeds along the side of the road, following the other man into the woods. He was definitely the youngest here. Several of these guys were old dudes, too old to join the military even with their relaxed requirements. They set off, and Timothy scanned the hilly woods, breaking the area down into a two-dimensional canvas just like his dad had taught him, surveying it from left to right and then back again, looking for any sign of movement. The beasts could easily camouflage themselves to blend in with the terrain, but they were easier to spot when they moved. Leaves and twigs crunched under the weight of their boots as they marched deeper into the forest, the trees swallowing the group. Timothy made his way closer to Stephen, trying not to make too much noise.
"You're a brave kid," Stephen said quietly.
"Not a kid," Timothy whispered back.
Stephen's mouth curled into a smirk.
"Bullshit. I knew your dad. You aren't 18. I just figured if you're anything like your old man, we could use your help."
So he did know. Timothy simply nodded. They walked for the next 30 minutes into the forest, searching for any sign of buildings, tracks, or a trail. He wasn't the best tracker, but he could have spotted human footprints had they come across any. Stephen halted and pulled out a compass. Then he put it away and pulled out a bottle of water. He handed it to Timothy. Timothy brought the bottle to his lips and downed a third of it. His stomach growled. They hadn't come prepared for being out here so long. This was supposed to be quick.
"Thanks," Timothy said, handing it back.
An older man with glasses stood and pointed.
"I think I see something."
Timothy brought up his shotgun, but he didn't have a scope to zoom in on whatever it was this guy was pointing at.
"I don't see shit," Stephen said.
The older man looked away with a frown.
"I'm sorry. My old eyes must be playing tricks on me."
Stephen slowly lowered his rifle and picked the bottle of water off the ground.
"Let's keep moving," he said. "If we don't..."
Crows burst from the trees to the east, filling the late afternoon with their calls. The men all aimed their rifles in that direction. Timothy moved his finger to the trigger.
After blinking away the sting of sweat in his eyes, he searched the carpet of leaves littering the forest floor for movement, and then the phalanx of trees around them. He saw nothing out there but skeletal branches shedding more leaves. The crows flapped away, silhouetted against the blue sky, their cries fading. Silence again shrouded the group. They remained frozen for what felt like an hour. One of the men tried to keep his rifle up, but it wobbled in his grip, the weight too much for his old muscles to support. Stephen took a few steps, his boots making a faint crunch over the leaves. He gave the advance signal toward where the birds had taken off. Timothy fell in next to him. They walked slowly toward a cluster of massive trees that towered into the sky. The older man with glasses turned to wait. A flash of movement in the branches far above the man's head caught Timothy's attention. The few remaining leaves rustled on one particularly large branch. This one looked different than the others, like it had something clinging to it. Two reptilian eyes suddenly focused on him. Before he could raise his shotgun, the camouflaged variant let go of the branch and pounced. The beast slammed into the guy with the glasses. Leaves and dirt exploded into the air. Timothy aimed his shotgun, but before he could get a clean shot, the beast dragged the man around a tree.
"Help me!"
he wailed. A second militia soldier slammed into the ground with a thud, a variant standing atop his chest. He fired off a burst, but the rounds hit the dirt. All at once, a dozen beasts poured from between the tree trunks. They had all taken on the colors of the forest. Timothy fired on the beast straddling the second downed soldier just as it slashed the guy's throat open. The shotgun pellets hit the creature in the chest, punching into vital organs. The crack of automatic gunfire came from both sides as Stephen and the two remaining militia soldiers fired on the encroaching monsters. Timothy pumped his shotgun and fired at the creatures. Stephen dropped several beasts with headshots. Timothy's aim wasn't as good. His shots harmlessly hit trees and dirt. In less than a minute, he was out of shells. He backpedaled as he struggled to pull more from his sweatshirt and load them into the shotgun. He dropped one in the grass, fingers trembling, but managed to load the next two.
"Run!"
Stephen yelled over the gunfire. Timothy took off with the other two soldiers. Stephen led them, turning every few moments to shoot off a burst or two. Turning, Timothy did the same, firing the two shells.
"I'm out,"
Stephen said, grabbing a new magazine. Timothy was out too. He reached into his sweatshirt pocket. There were no more shells there. He threw his shotgun away and snatched his pistol from his holster. He twisted to fire wildly behind him while Stephen reloaded. In the seconds it took to fire, Timothy glimpsed at least a dozen of the sinewy beasts moving between the trees. They were on all fours, but they were slinking in and out of cover rather than running straight into the gunfire at full speed. A hidden variant lunged and took down the soldier running behind Timothy and Stephen. The talons slashed his face off. His screams faded as the beast dragged him away.
"Come on!"
Stephen yelled. Timothy bolted after him. The man paused and fired until his bolt locked back, and he was forced to replace the magazine. They ran like that for almost 10 minutes, covering each other to hold the beasts at bay. The variants grew more desperate, their screeches closing in. Stephen and Timothy let loose a flurry of gunfire. The rounds dropped some of the creatures still pursuing them.
"Move it, kid!"
Stephen shouted. They couldn't be far from the road now. Timothy spotted two hills he thought he recognized. The road was just on the other side. Stephen stopped again to lay down more covering fire before leading them down the first of the two hills. Timothy kept his balance, but Stephen tripped and fell. He got right back up and kept running. Timothy charged ahead, trying not to slide, and then ran across a creek, his boots splashing up muddy water. He bolted up the next slope with Stephen close behind. Halfway up, a shriek sounded from the crest of the first bluff.
"Keep going!"
Stephen shouted. He turned to fire, giving Timothy time to get to the top. When he reached the crest, Timothy turned with his pistol, aiming at a pack of variants loping down toward the creek. Three of the creatures jumped into the water with a splash. Stephen stood his ground, firing bursts with his rifle. Timothy squeezed his trigger as fast as he could. Most of the wild shots missed, but a few made their mark. The creatures that were brought down were replaced by more barreling down the hill. They were no longer held back by caution now that it was only Timothy and Stephen left. Stephen turned and locked eyes with Timothy, just as the beasts swarmed him.
Run,
he screamed.
Run, kid!
The beasts pulled him to the ground, ripping through his clothing and flesh with their claws. Timothy took a step backward, nearly frozen by fear. It wasn't until one of the beasts locked eyes with him that he snapped out of it. Turning, he ran onto the road, looking left and then right. The truck was still there.
Help!
He shouted. Waving his hands, he ran toward it. A variant screeched behind him, bursting onto the road. It dropped to all fours and bounded toward him. There was no way he would make it to the truck in time. Halting, he closed one eye and then fired at the beast. The first two shots missed, but the third and fourth clipped the monster in the upper chest. The fifth shot punched into the skull, finishing it off. It crashed to the ground, kicking up a cloud of dust. Timothy ran, not stopping until he got to the passenger side of the pickup. He opened the door and jumped into the cab. It was empty. The driver was gone. Blood soiled the driver's seat. The window was broken. Pebbles of safety glass spread over the floor. Timothy climbed into the driver's seat and reached down to start the engine, but the key was missing. He looked up as two variants skittered onto the road in front of the truck. Heart pounding, Timothy ejected the magazine of his pistol and slapped another one home. It was his last. Not nearly enough for the rest of the variants that would be on him shortly. Without the keys, he was going to die. He thought he wasn't afraid of death, but the icy grip of fear washed over his muscles as the variants charged. Timothy raised the gun in a shaky hand and pulled the trigger. Chapter 5 The USS George Johnson sailed farther away from the First Fleet, putting distance between President Ringgold and the majority of their remaining Navy. Everything she had worked so hard to achieve had become an inferno back on the mainland, and this time she feared she couldn't put out the flames. She sat in her new office that doubled as what would be her quarters for the foreseeable future. The small space had belonged to a dead officer, and the evidence of his life still haunted every corner. An empty picture frame that read Dad was adhered to the bulkhead, and a Bible with dog-eared pages rested in one of the drawers. It hadn't felt right to remove those little memorials to the man's life. The dimly lit, cold room felt more like a prison cell than home, but it still beat being underground. You're safe here, she thought. Repeating those words didn't relieve her anxiety. In fact, the more she reminded herself of her own safety, the more guilty she felt. Hundreds, if not thousands, of people had perished over the past 24 hours, and she had fled just like she had done during the first war. The country and the world had already lost so much to the monsters. Almost an entire generation wiped out, and the youngest generation of adults that had survived the first war now faced another. She dreaded the thought of sending youth out there to fight the monsters or to eradicate American history by destroying what was left of their cities with bombs. But now she wasn't sure she had any other options. One thing was certain. We have to fight. She took a moment to look at herself in the mirror before setting off for her next strategy meeting. Her dark skin had more wrinkles than she remembered, and deep bags hung under her eyes. It wasn't exactly a surprise. She had only slept a few hours. A splash of water on her face helped snap her alert. She repeated something she had said to Dr. Kate Lovato near the end of the first war. There is always hope. She drew in a deep breath, straightened her back, and pushed open the hatch. Marines posted outside threw up salutes. She returned the salutes and hurried through the passages to the Combat Information Center, CIC. Most of her staff and the officers were already there. Some looked like they had been there since the night before. They all rose from their chairs and stations to salute and greet her. Good morning, President Ringgold. I hope you got a few hours of sleep, Vice President Lemke said.
Madam President, said General Souza.
Judging by the glassiness in his eyes, he hadn't slept in days. His LNO, Lieutenant Festa, also looked equally exhausted. Lay it on me, she said.
The good news is that we haven't lost any more outposts, Souza said.
Even the ones around Minneapolis, Chicago, Lincoln, Kansas City, Indianapolis, and Columbus survived last night.
He passed her a briefing folder.
Casualties at those outposts, however, are very high. In some cases, over half the defense forces were wiped out, Festa said.
Cortez crossed her chest in silent prayer, and Soprano looked at the deck.
We are in the process of evacuating people by air and pulling them to more protected places, including locations where it will be more difficult for the variants to tunnel under our defenses, Sousa said. I have a list of outposts for you to review later.
Festa handed a second folder across the table. She took it, but didn't want to look right now. She was having a hard enough time keeping it together. This all felt like a bad dream.
Do we know enemy numbers yet? She asked.
Early estimates project somewhere in the hundreds of thousands with the addition of the juveniles, Festa said. We gave them a good pounding last night, but most returned to their hives before we could get accurate estimates. That could make sending in any teams to find the remaining masterminds a suicide mission, Sousa said, clenching his square jaw. But we did it before, and we can do it again. We have teams on standby waiting for your orders.
She glanced at Lemke.
What do you think, Dan?
We're trying to come up with other ways to find the mastermind variants, he replied. I'm hoping Dr. Lovato and Dr. Carr will eventually help us locate them through the webbing in all those tunnels. But so far they haven't come up with anything we can use.
Sousa cleared his throat.
All due respect to Dr. Lovato and her team, but we're running out of time for science, and something tells me we haven't even seen the full power of the variant army yet. Last night was merely the vanguard to what I expect will be a more powerful assault than we've ever seen before.
The implications chilled Ringgold to her core. She couldn't shake the fact they hadn't seen this coming over the past 8 years. While she partially blamed her advisors and generals, she also felt the heavy burden of failure herself.
How did we miss this? She said, exasperated. We monitored all 6 target cities and sent missions into variant territory. We didn't see any evidence of juveniles or the masterminds.
No one had an answer.
I'm sorry, General Sousa said. If you would like my resignation, I have already drafted it.
She thought on it, but shook her head.
We can't dwell on failure. We have to focus on saving our people.
We're already fortifying all of our outposts, Sousa said. We're withdrawing from those around the target cities to concentrate our forces. That will also give you the option of nuking them if you so choose. And finally, we're requesting armed support from Europe.
They aren't experiencing attacks like this? She asked.
Not yet, Nelson said. All our requests for support have been received lukewarm at best. They fear helping us will leave them vulnerable.
Has anyone promised anything?
The French, Russians, and Brits have sent us a few aircraft, Nelson said.
How many?
The National Security Advisor tightened his red tie.
How many, Nelson? Ringgold repeated.
A total of 10 planes, Madam President.
He swallowed.
Not fighter jets. These are jumbo jets to help evacuate people.
She sighed.
I'll talk to my counterparts directly today. You keep pressing your contacts.
Yes, ma'am, I will.
Ringgold didn't expect much, but they needed more than 10 extra planes to repel this invasion. She had opened the doors to refugees from other countries, feeling responsible for the virus that the military had unleashed on the world. But she wasn't exactly surprised the leaders of other countries were reluctant to help the Allied states now.
What else do you all have for me? Ringgold asked.
By sunset, we hope to have most fortifications complete, Sousa said. We've also got a fleet of private planes and helicopters that have been serviced and put back into commission. But even with those, it won't be enough to complete the evacuations from the worst-hit outposts by then. And if the variants do attack again...
Another shiver coursed through Ringgold's body.
What about evacuations by land? She asked. We could try to pull people back in convoys.
That's already happening in some places, but anyone that leaves in a convoy risks being attacked on the road, Festa said. People are too afraid of driving in variant country.
We really need more help to win this fight and get everyone to safety, Lemke said.
He raised his chin slightly.
If our international allies can't offer that support, I suggest turning inward.
He paused, and then said,
Madam President,
I think we should consider reaching out to General Cornelius. He's got 2,000 men and a load of aircraft and vehicles at his disposal. Plus, he's already arrived at Fisher Fields to secure the petroleum supply. Ringgold looked at the man who she had hoped would succeed her as president. He was suggesting she ask his political opponent for help, which wasn't all that shocking considering their situation, but it still took her slightly off guard. "The election doesn't matter now," Lemke continued. "Saving our country and our people is all that I care about. If Cornelius can help us, I say it's worth setting aside differences." "You're talking about negotiating with your opponent," Ringgold reminded her vice president. "If we ask him for help, he will in turn ask for favors, some that we're not going to like and some that I can't accept, like nuking the cities and conscripting our young people." Lemke nodded. "I know. But we might have to negotiate if we want to save what's left of the Allied States." She used a moment to think. Lemke was right about needing Cornelius. She just hoped the general was more reasonable than he had been in the past. "Okay, Dan. Talk to General Cornelius and inform him that we're officially putting the election on hold," Ringgold said. "It's time to try and work together." Fisher would have preferred his private jet and the luxuries that came with it, including a cold brew and fresh steak from his ranch. Rare, of course. But those days were over. He sat in the belly of a V-22 Osprey. It was certainly a fine piece of machinery, though luxurious was definitely not the word he would use to describe it or the flight from his ranch to Galveston. The thrum of the engines reverberated straight into his bones. He was strapped into a seat along the bulkhead of the tilt-rotor aircraft beside his most loyal men, Tran and Chase. Sergeant Sharp sat close by. He had insisted on coming, even though he wasn't assigned to Cornelius's private army. The six soldiers that wore Orca badges didn't seem to trust Sergeant Sharp or appreciate his presence. But Fisher sure trusted him, especially after Sharp had risked his life to protect Fisher Fields. Their priority had changed overnight, from saving the fields to saving what remained of the Allied States. From the reports still coming in, salvaging what was left of the country was going to take more than oil from his fields. They needed a bigger army. Fisher's stomach twisted as the Osprey began to bank slightly northeast. He tried to focus on the purpose of this meeting, and although he had his suspicions, he wasn't sure why they needed to meet face to face. Being in the oil business and defending his fields against the variants, he had come to expect all kinds of nasty surprises in life. He wouldn't be shocked if this upcoming meeting with the general was one of them.
"Got about 20 minutes before we touch down," Sharp said.
"Any hostiles we should worry about?" Tran asked.
"Nope. Once you see this place, you'll understand why."
It didn't take long before Fisher saw for himself. Galveston Island stretched below them, basking in sunlight. Murky brown waters lapped against yellow sandy shores on the eastern side and piers to the west. The long landmass trailed south, but most of the activity was contained within the northern city limits of Galveston. The Osprey curved through the sky, providing a closer view of the outpost. Thick concrete walls traced the perimeter. Guard towers crested multiple positions, giving sweeping views over the water and rest of the island. On the eastern shore, walls overlooked beaches of razor wire. Fisher had once heard of variants that had evolved gills and were capable of amphibious assaults. Cornelius clearly had seen the intel and was not taking any chances with his defenses. Another group of soldiers piled corpses on a pier at the end of the beach past a ruined Ferris wheel. The only way to the island by foot was via the heavily garrisoned port or the long bridge connecting Galveston to the mainland. Concrete barriers and mounds of sandbags were set in various locations to slow attackers, providing ample opportunity for the machine gun nests to riddle hostiles with bullets. Heavily armed patrols and armored vehicles were posted along the docks. Another set of gates there would thwart any waterborne invaders mistakenly looking for an easy entry.
"Impressive," Fisher said.
"Yeah, but I see a big problem, sir," Chase said.
"What would you have added?" Fisher asked.
"I would have left a small section of beach for laying out. but with all that razor wire, it doesn't look like soaking in the sun with any babes is in the cards.
Galveston's fun in the sun days are over for now, said one of the soldiers across the seats.
The guy sitting next to him joined in and said,
There used to be an Ironman triathlon here. I finished it once, but the only swimming, biking, and running people are doing here now is to get away from the monsters. Not exactly the kind of stuff that makes you want to lounge around.
Man, you're killing me, Chase said. Can I at least find a place that serves cerveza?
The Osprey's engines roared as the tilt rotors turned vertical. They descended toward a makeshift heliport on a large parking lot abutting the wall overlooking the beach. A jolt shuddered through the aircraft when the wheels touched asphalt. The crew chief lowered the rear ramp, and Sharp led the group out into the salty breeze that also carried the acrid scent of petroleum. Vacation homes on stilts and restaurants surrounded the parking lot. Most of the homes had been transformed into barracks or offices now, but the restaurants appeared active, or at least the kitchens were. Lines of soldiers and civilians stretched out the front of a few seafood joints that had busy patios. Across the parking lot, two Blackhawks had set down. These didn't look like the military craft Fisher had seen at other outposts. Graffiti covered the hulls with call signs. The troops milling around the choppers all wore blue armbands with the Orca insignia that Dees had worn. Flapping in the wind high above the parking lot was a flag with the same logo.
Welcome now, Post Galveston, said the triathlete soldier. We got a limo waiting. Follow me.
Fisher let out a low chuckle when he saw a Humvee parked nearby. The road took them through a residential area with a view of the beach. Most of the people out here were soldiers. He saw very few civilians. From their hurried actions and constant arrival and departure of aircraft, Fisher got the feeling that this place operated like a well-oiled machine. There was no hemming and hawing, politicking, or bickering. There was a singular mission here, and everyone on Galveston shared in it. Defend the outpost from the monsters. But it hadn't always been this way. Fisher had heard Outpost Galveston was a slum 4 years before General Cornelius arrived.
Cornelius built all this? Fisher asked the driver.
Yes, sir. He brought this place back to life and managed the construction of the fortifications himself. If it weren't for him, no one here would have survived.
I see, Fisher said, fidgeting with his mustache.
He was beginning to respect Cornelius more and more. The streets passed by in a blur of motion. Everyone had a job, ranging from putting up fresh razor wire to cleaning weapons. It struck Fisher then. This was the future of the Allied States. The Humvee ground to a halt in front of what once had been a fancy hotel neighboring the port. A pair of guards opened the door to the Humvee and gestured for Fisher and his men to follow. Sharp went with them into the lobby of the hotel. Desks had been set up around the ornate space. Chandeliers cast white light over men and women carrying on trenchant conversations at scattered tables.
This way, said a guard.
He led them to the back of the room, where two double doors were shut. Tran and Chase stepped up, but the guard shook his head.
Only Mr. Fisher is allowed inside.
Fisher exchanged a glance with his men, and then nodded.
I'm with Mr. Fisher, Sharp said.
Fisher took off his 10-gallon hat. The guard nodded and let them into the room. General Cornelius sat behind the table talking with two officers. As soon as the doors opened, he rose from his seat and walked briskly from behind the table.
Mr. Fisher, so glad to have you join us, Cornelius said, clasping his hand. I appreciate you making the journey.
And I appreciate you saving my oil fields, Fisher replied. You got quite an operation set up here.
All the better to prepare for the next stage of war.
Cornelius glanced over to Sharp.
And you are? Sergeant Ken Sharp, United States Army, sir,
Sharp said, snapping to attention.
He's with me, Fisher said. Sharp gave a lot to protect my fields before your men showed up. Lost all but one of his own, too.
Thank you for your service, Sergeant, Cornelius said. Please make yourself comfortable. We've got a lot to discuss.
Fisher and Sharp sat down as the general went to the other side of the table.
I take it you didn't bring me here just to convince me to support you for the election, Fisher said.
Cornelius smirked.
No, Mr. Fisher.
If we don't act soon, we won't have a country left. And without a country, I see no point in having an election.
No thanks to President Ringgold, Sharp muttered.
Cornelius didn't respond to the comment. Realization hit Fisher. He got the sense Sharp hadn't come here to help. He had come here to switch sides.
I've asked you here for your support, but not the political kind, Cornelius said. Earlier, in fact, I got off a call with Vice President Lemke. We've come to an agreement that we'll work together for the better good of the country. The election is on hold.
Fisher wasn't completely shocked to hear that, but the agreement did take him by surprise. He guessed there was some intense negotiations going on to get a guy like Cornelius to team up with the president and vice president.
You saw our defenses, Cornelius said.
Fisher nodded.
All have been effective against the variants until now. Monsters that tunnel underground and appear beneath and behind walls that have kept them out for 8 years have changed the game.
Indeed.
Our scouts can't find them. Even our choppers and drones can't spot them before they hit us.
Right. And that makes this outpost a damn fine choice, Fisher said. The gulf on one side and bay on the other will ensure this place is hard to hit. The sandy soil on the neighboring mainland makes it hard for beasts to maintain the tunnel's structural integrity, too.
Exactly. I figured you would notice. Any man worth his salt in the oil and gas industry has at least a basic understanding of geology. More than just a basic one. You and your engineers are some of the best petroleum producers in this country, and we need you for more than that now.
Fisher braced himself.
I could use someone like you for a special project that could change the tide of this new war, Cornelius said. Someone with your experience with all the gizmos and gadgets used to find oil deposits to help us identify variant tunnels on a large-scale basis.
Fisher stroked his mustache, listening.
We've reached somewhat of an impasse. Our R2TD systems work well at identifying variant tunnels, but their range is extremely limited, and they can't cover much area effectively.
You're looking for something more efficient, Fisher said. Something that can defend a whole outpost. You're talking about seismic vibrations, aren't you?
Precisely. And here's the deal. We've located a few vibra-sized trucks from some defunct oil and gas companies outside Houston. They've already been moved out to El Paso. But what I really need are men that know how to work this equipment. Men like yours.
Fisher's mind swam back to the destruction of his fields and the casualties he endured. Before he'd been swept away to Galveston, his staff was still tallying up the dead and missing.
How many you reckon you'll need? He asked.
Just one team to start. Maybe 8 or 9 engineers.
Last count I made, we might only have 20 left. That's barely enough to run and repair the oil fields.
I have a feeling you're a man who knows how to make limited resources work. Can you spare even a handful?
For this project, I'll find a way to make it happen, Fisher replied.
Well, then if you agree, I'll call in an airlift to move your engineers from Fisher Fields to El Paso right now. They can be there before you arrive tonight.
Fisher wasn't sure he had a choice in the matter.
We need to prove that this tunnel-identifying technology works, Cornelius said. I'm counting on you and your team to make that happen.
Point of clarification, sir.
Go ahead.
When you talk about the entire Allied States, I do want to be clear that my handful of engineers and whatever equipment you've moved to El Paso isn't going to be enough to take care of 100 other outposts.
Of course not. I've got a plan for that, Mr. Fisher. One that involves some technology that we've neglected for far too many years. But you don't need to worry about that for now. Think of El Paso as a trial run, an experiment to show how this strategy is worth pursuing. If all goes well, we will change the tide, like I said earlier.
An end to those vile beasts that had taken so much from him and his men was an opportunity Fisher simply would never pass up. He stood and reached across the table to shake Cornelius's hand.
Sir, you've got yourself a deal. Fisher Fields is up for the challenge.
Glad to hear you say that, because this work in El Paso isn't exactly going to be safe.
Cornelius sat back down in his chair.
You will be well protected, but you might have to get up close and personal with the variants for this to be a success.
Chapter 6 The exodus into the University of Southern Maine was well underway by late afternoon, and Timothy still wasn't back. Beckham and Horn stood in the back of a parked pickup truck outside the campus. People streamed by on their way to the Garrison campus in preparation for what Lieutenant Niven and Beckham believed could be an imminent variant attack. Beckham couldn't help but wonder if any of these people were collaborators. Paranoia set in as they passed. Some glanced up, but most kept their gaze downward, trudging along like so many refugees Beckham had seen in war-torn countries trying to escape bloodshed. They carried suitcases, backpacks, and rolled-up sleeping bags. He didn't see any collaborators here. He saw innocents looking for refuge. For now, all he could do was trust Ruckley and Niven had the situation under control and find his friends. He searched the slow-moving group of hundreds for Donna and Beau. Horn nursed his last cigarette. For the last time in a while, Beckham felt like taking a drag. He needed something to take the edge off. He was trying not to worry about Timothy. That proved difficult, considering the kid had taken off after the collaborators strayed into variant territory. For now, there wasn't anything Beckham and Horn could do but wait. They'd asked Lieutenant Niven for help, but Niven wouldn't commit any forces to going out into the field. Frankly, Beckham didn't blame him for not wanting to send out any spare men. In truth, there weren't any spare men. They needed every person that could hold a weapon to stay stationed at the campus for whenever the collaborators and variants struck next. If the monster's behavior in the past was any indication, the beasts would send everything they had in the next attack, and it would come soon. Come nightfall, Beckham worried they would face an army no one even knew existed until recently, an army that had hidden in the shadows, biding its time as it grew to horrific numbers.
"Hurry up, folks," a ranger said.
"Almost there. Keep moving," said another.
Sergeant Ruckley and her 12-person team of rangers from the Iron Hogs helped keep the mess of people moving. They patrolled the sidewalk, keeping an eye on the masses and encouraging them to keep going forward. Beckham scanned the dreary faces again, but still didn't see Donna and Beau. All he knew was that they had hunkered down at a hotel with the other survivors of Peaks Island the night before. The plan was to get them back to the USS George Johnson, and this time Beckham vowed not to leave them behind. He figured he and Horn could stay in the field to help for at least a few more hours. He certainly wasn't going to abandon the outpost this time, especially without knowing Timothy's fate.
"Yo, boss,"
Horn suddenly said. Beckham glanced over.
"Do you see Donna and Beau?"
"Nah, but I was thinking. You know what the good news is about the world falling apart again?"
"I have a feeling you're going to tell me."
"I don't have to listen to you giving some silly-ass campaign speech."
Beckham couldn't help but smirk.
"True. You know what else is good news?"
Horn blew smoke skyward and shrugged.
"I don't have to see your donkey ass try and squeeze into a suit."
"Donkey ass?"
Horn spat onto the pavement.
"You haven't called me that for a really long time."
"That's what Panda used to call you, isn't it?"
"Man, I miss that big son of a bitch."
"Me too.
And the kid."
Beckham thought of Alex Riley, the Delta Force operator that had become wheelchair-bound after breaking both legs in New York City. He had later lost his life to the bone collector Alpha on Plum Island. It was one of the deaths that had sent Beckham close to the edge. If it weren't for Kate and Horn, he would have lost it back then and probably gotten himself killed. But people like them and Fitz had kept him sane. They had motivated him to keep his head on his shoulders instead of doing something rash, something like what Beckham feared Timothy was doing.
"There they are,"
Horn said, pointing with his smoldering cigarette. Donna winced with each step as she leaned on her son. Both had their eyes on the road.
"Come on,"
Horn said. He hopped out of the pickup bed to the street. Beckham wasn't as agile with his prosthetic leg. He sat down on the lift gate and slid down.
"Reed!" came a voice.
Beau worked his way through the throng, helping his mom. She hobbled on a bandaged ankle, but her eyes brightened when she saw them.
"You came back," she said.
We shouldn't have left without you, Beckham said. I'm sorry. It was chaos last night.
You had no choice, Bo said. But I almost punched one of those soldiers hold me back.
Good thing you didn't, or we'd be bailing you out of the stockade, Horn said.
Have you guys seen Timothy? Donna asked. He took off after the helicopters left, and we haven't seen him since.
We heard he went out with the militia, Horn said. We've been waiting for him to come back, but...
Beckham glanced at his watch, and then looked at the skyline. They only had a couple of hours of light left. If Timothy didn't come back before then, the chances of him coming back at all would be close to zero.
Hey, you found your friends, came a voice.
Ruckley made her way over to the sidewalk and stopped near the pickup.
This is Bo and Donna Tufo, Beckham said.
Nice to meet you, Ruckley said. Hate to break this up, but you really should get moving so we can assign you a room or a tent.
She eyed Bo.
You should have a weapon.
Aren't we leaving with you? Donna asked Beckham.
Soon enough, but we might stay the night yet, Beckham said. I wanted to wait and see if...
I say we stay here and fight, Bo interrupted.
Donna looked at her son.
What? I don't want to run, Bo said. We did that 8 years ago, and look where that got us. The monsters are back. It's time to fight, Mom. We're survivors, not fighters. Your dad tried to fight and died as a result. So many other people did too. I can't lose you now, Bo.
She's right, kid, Horn said. You don't have any combat training.
I'll learn, Bo said.
You sound like Timothy, Donna said, her face growing red.
Where do you think he is now?
The words silenced all of them. Even Ruckley looked at the ground, until her radio buzzed and she held up a hand excusing herself. She walked away for some privacy.
Bo, I'm begging you. Please don't do this right now, Donna said. Let's just get to the campus for now. We can talk more later.
Bo held his mom's gaze.
All right, he said finally.
Beckham placed a hand on Bo's shoulder.
You're making the right choice.
Then he looked to Donna.
Come on, we'll give you guys a ride.
Donna wrapped her arm around Bo's shoulder. He helped her into the passenger seat of the single cab pickup. Horn took the wheel, and Beckham climbed in the bed with Bo.
Hold up, Ruckley called out.
By the look on her face, Beckham could tell she had news for him.
What is it? He asked.
I told my team to keep an ear out for word on Timothy. A corporal just found out one of the two militia trucks returned to campus an hour ago, Ruckley said. From what the militia told us, your friend Timothy is part of another group that stayed out there to hunt down the collaborators.
Beckham growled out a curse.
Did they say where Timothy's group was last seen?
Horn asked.
No, Ruckley said, but they're still at the staging area. You can ask them yourselves if you want.
A loud voice called out behind her. One of the other rangers was arguing with the straggling crowds.
Keep moving, he said in a tone just shy of a shout.
We need a ride too, a woman said, pointing at the truck. Why do they get one?
I better handle this, Ruckley said. The staging area is between Woodbury Campus Center and Masterton Hall. I'll meet you there. Beckham nodded and tapped the side of the pickup. Horn pulled onto the curb and over the grass to another road curving through a residential area. Then he turned onto Bedford Street and headed for the checkpoints. Ahead, soldiers and civilians worked together to create sandbag fortifications for machine gunners, and forklifts moved concrete barriers. Razor wire torn down from other areas of the outpost was being redistributed. Snipers and machine gunners perched on the top of the buildings. The university was quickly transforming into a fortress. Horn parked in the lot between Masterton Hall and the Woodbury Campus Center. Lines of people snaked away from tents set up in the lawn for temporary housing assignments. More lines had formed outside a shipping container on the back of a flatbed truck. Soldiers handed out weapons and ammunition to anyone that appeared capable of fighting. Bo jumped out of the pickup and helped Donna down from the cab.
You guys go get your temporary assignment for now, Beckham said. We're going to find these militia guys. I'll come back for you later, okay?
Donna hesitated, uncertainty crossing her face.
We promise, Horn said.
Beckham jerked his chin, and Horn followed him toward a cluster of pickup trucks and jeeps where about a dozen men in camouflaged fatigues had gathered. They were clearly militia judging by their shotguns, non-military clothing, and unkempt beards.
Were you the ones chasing the collaborators?
Horn called out. The men turned from their conversation to look at Beckham and Big Horn. A heavy-set bald man with a long goatee hanging to his chest walked over.
I was part of that group, he said. You got a problem? Yeah, we got a problem,
Horn started. Beckham put a hand on Horn's arm, trying to coax the man's burly aggression down a notch.
Problem is, we need to know what happened to the other truck. One of our friends was with them.
They ain't back yet, the militiaman said.
No shit, Horn said. Show us on a map where they went.
I can do y'all one better, the man said.
I can take you there.
Horn and Beckham exchanged a glance.
Just a 35-minute drive, the man said. My boys and I were thinking about going back out there in the morning. How about we wait until then?
We were thinking today, Beckham said. The man looked at the sky, eyes narrowed.
We can manage a short trip, but we gotta move fast if we want to be back before we lose the light.
What do you think, boss?
Horn asked.
I think this is our best chance, Beckham said.
Niven made it clear he isn't sending anyone anytime soon.
Better stop wasting time then,
Horn said. He pointed at the man with the goatee.
You driving or you want me to?
I'll drive, the guy said.
Anyone else coming?
The other man avoided his gaze.
The rest of you boys scared of the dark? The man said, then shrugged.
Guess it's just us three. Name's Sam, by the way.
Captain Reed Beckham and Master Sergeant Parker Horn, Beckham said.
Nice to meet you fellas, Sam said, shaking both their hands.
He led them to a single-cab Toyota pickup with a mounted M240 in the rusted bed. Beckham went for the passenger side door, and Horn climbed into the back. The diesel engine of a Humvee roared behind them, and the vehicle pulled up alongside them.
What the hell do you think you're doing? Ruckley growled. Timothy was our responsibility, Horn said. We promised his dad we would look after him. That's what we're going to do.
Team Ghost does not break promises, Beckham added. That lady back there? Donna, right? She was right about Timothy, Ruckley said. I hate saying it, but we all know he's probably already dead.
Probably doesn't mean 100%, Horn said.
Sergeant, I know you regret letting the collaborators get away during that first attack, Beckham said. This is your chance to get revenge.
Vicariously, through us, Horn said, leaning on the pickup's cab.
Ruckley clenched her jaw, fists trembling for a second. God damn it. You're putting me in a really shitty position here. If Niven finds out I let you go at this hour, my ass is toast.
We'll be back before he even knows, Horn said.
You fucking better be, Master Sergeant, she said. All due respect and all that other crap.
Can't hear you, Horn said. Because you were never here and didn't see me leave.